Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the long war. Today, my co-host is Benham Bentalibou, my friend and colleague at FDD. Benham focuses on Iranian security and political issues, and Benham knows so much more of the militias just about the Middle East and beyond. Benham, great to have you back on Generation Jihad.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no. Hey, it's your show too, Benham. Today, we're joined by our friend and colleague, Edmund Fitton Brown. Edmund is a senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project, and he is also the United Kingdom's former ambassador to Yemen. So Edmund knows a lot about what's going on in the region. Edmund's one of our most frequent guests, probably our most frequent guest at Generation Jihad. Welcome back, Edmund. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Edmund. We really enjoy our conversations with you. Today, we're going to talk about Iran and its access to resistance. You know, we've watched this play out since Israel's been play out in a way, I think, that doesn't surprise a lot of us Iran watchers and Iranian proxy watchers, but it's still stunning nonetheless. Since Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th of last year, Iran has leveraged its proxies throughout the Middle East to target both Israeli and U.S. interests. The militias in Iraq and Syria were attacking U.S. bases. That seems to be on hold, although I got to tell you, I'm frequently seeing these reports of small attacks on U.S. bases, but I can never get a confirmation. But that does seem to be on hold at the moment. Of course, you have the Houthis that have shut down basically trade moving through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, passing to the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. That's been a real significant, this one might be the most surprising and most effective of Iran's proxies. And then, of course, we have Hezbollah on Israel's northern border on a daily exchange of fire with the Israelis. We're waiting for that war to kick off. By all indications, the Israelis are holding off on targeting Hezbollah until it wraps up its operation in Gaza. And we have a lot of goings on that we've discussed in our last episode with Joe Truesman, with the U.S. not abstaining on the latest Security Council measure, which is going to, you know, give aid and comfort to Hamas. Let's face it, Hamas, another, or I wouldn't say a proxy, but maybe an ally of Iran. But Edmund and Benham, you may disagree. Hamas is going to be emboldened by this it's going to think that it can hold out and actually survive and win this war. But the origins of this go back almost 5 decades. The Iranian regime has been at odds with the U.S. since the founding of the Islamic Republic in 1979. I'll start with you, Edmund. What is the origin of this conflict between the U.S. and Iran, between Iran and Israel? How did this all begin?
Well, and indeed, Iran and the West. I think, you know, Iran, yes, definitely identifies the West with the United States and with Israel. Of course, we don't want to go too far back into history, but it would be wrong not to mention that there were sort of, you know, disputes that existed between the UK, the US, and Iran before the Iranian Revolution, and you know, a post Second World War period that probably set the scene to make the Iranian opposition to the Shah particularly anti-American and anti-British. So that we should acknowledge that much, but nothing remotely to justify the level of viciousness that we've seen from the Iranians ever since the revolution. And that started off, of course, with the hostage taking, the fact that the U.S. embassy in Tehran was violated, and U.S. diplomats were held hostage in Tehran at that time. And really that sort of signaled from that moment that Iran would not play by the rules. It would not respect the rules-based international system. It would violate diplomatic premises whenever it suited it to do so. It would violate the freedom of navigation on the high seas. In the way that the Houthis, of course, are now doing, as you mentioned, in the Red Sea, that it would carry out terrorist attacks, that it would threaten both Iranian and foreign nationals whom it disliked for one reason or another, and it would assassinate them or incite assassination against them. And in the UK, of course, the sort of the real shocking realization of that was when Salman Rushdie was subjected to the famous fatwa by Ayatollah Khomeini, whereby the Ayatollah essentially said, you know, this British author can be attacked and killed because his book is blasphemous. So this has been really a constant state of near conflict with Iran. It's never abated between 1979 and now. And one of the most striking milestones along the way was in 2003, when the United States and its allies invaded Iraq. Now, no matter what you think of that decision, whether you think it was properly justified, whether you think it was legal, whether you think it was politically wise or tactically sensible, we can all have a debate about that. But one thing that it very clearly was a benefit to Iran, because Iran is a Shia country and Iraq was under the control of a Sunni dictator, Saddam Hussein, who had himself invaded Iran and had used chemical weapons against Iran in the past. So when we sought to depose Saddam Hussein in 2003, that could only have been read by the Iranians as a very friendly and generous act. And yet within weeks of the first American and British troops arriving in Iraq, the Iranians started operating through their proxies, the Iraqi Shia militias, to kill British and American troops within weeks during 2003. That, I think, was the moment when I realized that there is no possibility of a constructive or good faith interaction with Iran. It is simply not capable under the mullahs who govern it. It is absolutely not capable of good faith relations with the West.
You know, you mentioned that I was 9 years old when the Iran hostage situation began. You said Iran wouldn't play by the rules. And, you know, one of the things that was obvious to me after it was over with was that Iran clearly wouldn't pay a price for not playing by the rules. And I realized there was a lot of complications at the time, you know, the midst of the Cold War, and don't want to, you know, send Iran into Russia's arms and things of that nature. But this, you know, it was clear to me, even as a 9-year old guy, I was a little bit weird. I really was interested in foreign policy and the war and following all that stuff. So I guess it's no shock I'm here where I am today. But, you know, I remember watching that and saying, boy, this is a real big problem. Benham, do you have anything to add to that? What is, you know, do we dismiss the religious motivations of the, not you, me, and Edmund, I think we understand that, but does the foreign policy community in general dismiss Iran's religious motivations for its opposition to the U.S. and the West?
Well, let me just begin by saying I do find that a bit odd, even though as a young man myself in the shadow of 9/11, also became increasingly interested in what the U.S. was doing and what was happening in the Middle East. But I didn't want to take that opportunity and flag for the audience. Nerd alert.
Yeah, it was a different world, Benham. I mean, there was no internet to research. Like, I was like a voracious reader of like Time Magazine and Newsweek. And my mom, bless her, she, you know, she bought me books and she fed my bizarre interest. Yeah, definite nerd alert. I admit it. You got me.
Well, no, that's okay, because these are formative moments in the making of someone's interest and worldview. And the reason I say formative moments in the making of someone's interest and worldview is that we fail to appreciate precisely what Edmund was saying in the beginning. What are the worldviews and interests of our adversaries today? We tend to downplay that and dismiss that. And it's not clear-cut religious ideology. It's a hybrid geopolitics, paranoia, power, misunderstandings, narratives that have no basis in reality, third worldism, Marxism, Islamism, ecumenical jihadism. There's tons of these inputs that go into the making of the likes of what someone like Supreme Leader, which is a very title meant to be taken rather literally in Iran, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei says, when you look at his speeches or how he has talked about Israel or the UK or America or Europe or the West in the past. These people cut their teeth on being anti-Western, and their short-term target was, prior to the revolution, the late Shah of Iran and the monarchical system. Their medium to long-term target was Israel, the UK, America, and the West. And prior to Khomeini, who was the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, prior to his death, he had penned a letter to then leader of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, asking him to repent and turn to Islam. That might sound kind of foolish to some, but Khomeini died in 89, and then the Soviet Union was dissolved a bit after, and the U.S. managed the transition to the post-Cold War order in the early 90s. But to the hardliners in Iran, the success they had against the Shah, the fact that they survived against Saddam, the fact that this other geopolitical pole just collapsed upon the weight of its own contradictions after the Supreme Leader had invited them to embrace Islam and they hadn't, continued in their view to prove that they were right. And they also believe that the West is collapsing. Much more recently, particularly after our decade in the region, particularly on the flanks of Iran in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the Iranians got up close and personal with the IRGC as well as with the proxies in trying to make life hell for the international coalition there. And they made life hell because of this belief that was not just Islamism or jihadism or dogma or geopolitics or, you know, a panoply of narratives from the third world about the imperial West, but also because of opportunism and also because they believe they had, you know, you hear a line in the West very often. They believe they were on the right side of history. They believe they had history on their side. And as much as we may believe we may have history on our side against our adversaries, be it against the likes of jihadist terrorism or a rising Russia and China, they, our adversaries, also believe they have history on their side, and they selectively take in facts to conform to that history. And when you look at that sponsorship of terrorism that Edmund was talking about, whether you go back to the storming of the U.S. Embassy in 1979, the bombing of the Marine Barracks in 83, the kind of international terrorism Iran sponsored, whether with Hezbollah or with the Dawa Party across the Middle East in the 1980s, the bombing of the Israeli Embassy in 92 in Buenos Aires, the bombing of the AMIA Cultural Center in 94 in Buenos Aires, the 96 Khobar Towers bombing, the killing over, I think, what's the number, 600, Bill?
Yeah.
600 plus?
Yes.
U.S. and international service persons just in Iraq alone during the formal occupation period of Iraq from 2003 to 2011 by these militias. Then you layer on the stuff they've been doing more recently, firing missiles at bases with no military response, taking out drones with no military response, having their militias rocket bases with lackluster military responses in a 10 to 1, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, 40 to 1 ratio. And you could see how they would believe that America, Israel, the West, the UK is a paper tiger, because these are the trend lines they're looking at. And there is their ideology, and we do devalue their ideology, which is a mistake, but they're also looking at a series of empirics. And the problem is, we should not be in the business of vindicating them on the empirics, on the data.
Yeah, it's, you know, Benham, that's the thing, right? They, you know, from their perspective, and really from ours, right? We have, the United States has all the military hardware, all the resources, the global reach. And yet Iran launches these attacks, as you know, time and time again, and survives them and ultimately begins to thrive and moves on to the next with little to no consequence. Of course, they think that the fate, that history is on their side. I would if I were them, right? You know, when the underdog is in its fifth decade, maybe they have a reason to believe. I mean, unfortunately, we've given it to them. You know, Edmund, you brought up a really interesting point. You know, even when U.S. and Iranian interests align, such as the, you know, ouster of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003, or the fight against ISIS with in both Syria and Iraq, Iran has, you know, despite this, Iran has turned against the U.S. when the U.S. has, you know, done it a favor, provided assistance. For instance, in Iraq, the U.S. was essentially serving as the air support for Iran's Shia proxies, as Iranian advisors were embedded with Iraqi security forces and Iraqi militias in the fight in northern and in western Iraq. And yet the Iranians still colluded against the United States. Why is this? Are the Iranians playing us for fools? Is this part of their strategy?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I said earlier, there is a real depth to this anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism, and anti-Israel motivation that the Iranians feel. So that is the defining motivation. It means that they'll look at anybody else in terms of, you know, how do they relate to that conflict. So one of the reasons why Iran is willing to host the leader of Al-Qaeda in Tehran, Saif al-Adel, is precisely that. It's not that Iran has a particular affinity with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a Sunni extremist organization, and Iran is the leading Shia power in the world. But the fact is that Al-Qaeda is primarily motivated to attack the United States, Israel, the West, just as Iran is. And so the Iranians then define that relationship in those terms. Of course, there's an element of realpolitik as well, sort of reinsuring. You don't want Al-Qaeda to attack you. And of course, if you've got their leader based in Tehran, then Al-Qaeda are not going to attack you. They would not want to bring down the kind of retribution that would invite. So I think that's part of it. I think the other thing that's really important to mention here, and this is where we have to be careful not to portray Iran as a superpower or as a giant. It's neither. It's a medium-sized country, medium-sized economy, and an economy that is struggling and is politically dysfunctional. There's very little doubt that if the Iranian people were able to organize and overcome the organs of intimidation and repression, that they would rapidly overthrow this government because it is deeply unpopular, it's corrupt, it's inefficient. So all of that, you know, let's remember that Iran is not that strong. Now, whether we're doing the best job of confronting it is, as you say, is definitely open to question. I think it's staggering the extent to which Iran has escaped consequences for most of its misbehavior over the last 45 years. But the other point I want to make about Iran is that it is an agent of chaos, and it is comfortable with chaos. And this is something that, you know, when we actually think about what does unite countries that feel an alliance with each other, you know, we often say, oh, it's because we're democracies, it's because we're liberal or something like that. No, the things that bring the United States, the UK, Western Europe, together with countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, it's actually being very committed to building prosperity and having the rule of law and stability that enables you to go about your business in a lawful way, an internationally lawful and domestically lawful way. And that's the real point here, is that Iran is an agent of chaos and Al-Qaeda is an agent of chaos. And of course, under Putin, Russia has become an agent of chaos as well. It wants to disrupt. And that's the point. We're really talking not about a sort of a divide that is religious or even really philosophical in political terms. It's more about people who believe in the rules-based international system and want to see the world evolve peacefully and the agents of chaos and the disruptors.
Now, for the listeners who haven't, this is the first time being introduced to Edmund. Edmund also previously served as the director for the United Nations Analytical Support and Sanctions Monitoring Team for the Security Council, right? And so when he talks about Al-Qaeda's presence in Iran, you know, we all should listen. He's very, very familiar with that. And again, that's a great example, right, of Edmund, of, you know, what seemingly should be enemies. Iran has created an alliance to deal with, you know, to take advantage of the chaos, because the United States, which Iran, of course, calls the great Satan, you know, that's the bigger enemy. So it'll make alliances with groups like Al-Qaeda. It'll turn its back to, you know, to many other terrorist groups or even support them in order to achieve its goals. Do you have anything to add to that, Benham?
Yeah, just a little footnote. Edmund was talking about how perceptively what we were doing on Iran's right flank against the Taliban and on Iran's left flank against Saddam Hussein should or would have been seen as, you know, a net benefit to the Iranians. And in fact, that's one of the main vectors of the, you know, critique in America today against the Bush administration, which did that, which is that you ended up empowering Iran. But it's very important to realize that in all of the very limited places, particularly to the early part of the right flank, to the U.S.-Iran experience in Afghanistan prior to the onset of the Iraq War, even the cooperation, which was augmented by the laissez-passer Iran was giving with Al-Qaeda, even the cooperation faced a political cap. You guys may remember this really good profile of Qasem Soleimani by Dexter Filikens, I think back in 2012 or 2013, if I'm not mistaken, And it details part of this cooperation. And I think it was with then Ambassador Ryan Crocker, and then an Iranian negotiator that was somehow linked to the IRGC, giving the Americans locations to hit on a map, sharing his map with them. And the U.S. team is asking if they can, you know, take notes based on the map the Iranians are showing them. And in the story, very emphatically, the Iranians say, you can keep the map. You know, the Iranians are able to benefit from either wins or losses, mistakes or opportunities that we enact around them in the Middle East. And in places where it may look like we may do something based on a convergence of interest, they are going to run much, much faster into an ideological cap that limits and downblends their ability to cooperate or transcend an issue. So at most, what you'll get with the Iranians, given this ideology, given what Edmund was saying, which is this anti-status quo worldview, you will get a cap to anything that could be perceptibly seen as cooperative, because we shouldn't be thinking of this problem as a nation state problem, even though Iran is a nation state. In fact, it's one of the oldest kind of organic polities in the Middle East. Iran today is smaller than it's ever been in history. So when people talk about predation and imperialism, it's a fundamentally different form and different type. There is regime interest and national interest. There's Iran and there's the Islamic Republic. There is a reason why the I in the IRGC is not Iranian. It is Islamic. This is inherently a transnational problem. And it is to that end that Iran will find and has been able to find, whether they're transnational or localized non-state actors that have transnational or nationalist aspirations, whether it's Hamas or Al-Qaeda, whether it's the Houthis or Hezbollah, and be able to support them. And then increasingly what we're seeing is Iran come under the patronage and establish itself from junior partner to medium partner to other anti-status quo global opponents of the West, which is China and Russia. And it is this trend line that is exceptionally worrying, or should be exceptionally worrying, for policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic that are interested in not just having a rules-based order for the sake of a rules-based order, and not even just having it for the sake of business, but for the sake of the kind of baseline health, welfare, prosperity, and more importantly, security that that kind of a system can promote. Because the Islamic Republic and its agents of chaos above it, Russia and China, and below it, Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, what have you, the axis of resistance, as I like to say, their message is only resonant amid chaos. And they can effectuate their foreign and security policy goals amid chaos. You cannot have Hamas, the Houthis, the various Iran-backed Shia militias come out of Switzerland. You need semi-failed states. You need downtrodden and dispossessed people around you. You need a population that is cowered or pushed into thinking that there is no way out but through. And that's what the Islamic Republic is great at: finding a grievance that already exists, co-opting it, harboring it, and then providing material support for it. And that's precisely how a country which, if you look at the empirics, weak on paper as it is able to punch above its weight. So Edmund is right. It's not a 12 out of 10 on the threat scale. It's not a 2 out of 10 on the threat scale. It's a 6, 7, 8, and it's growing. And it's growing in these qualitatively new ways that is challenging these series of pro-status quo, stability-oriented, stability-interested actors, whether they're in the Middle East or out here in the West.
Yeah, it's interesting. You both really come to the same conclusion, right? That Iran capitalizes on chaos. And I have to agree. 100%. You know, and you're right. Iran is, you know, we often make our enemies out to be, you know, the you know, 100-foot monsters. And, you know, people did this with the Islamic State, with Al-Qaeda in the war on terror. They were never this, but it didn't mean they weren't a significant threat. I mean, which of our enemies knocked down, you know, buildings in New York City and caused the death of 3,000 Americans and other, you know, citizens of other countries? I mean, you know, China hasn't done this. Russia hasn't done this. That doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda was a bigger threat or a lesser threat. It just means it's another threat we had to deal with. And, you know, you mentioned the growing threat. And I think what we witnessed with the Houthis, let's leave Hamas's activities aside, because I think this was always sort of the goal. And we could see that on the horizon. But nobody was looking at the Houthis shutting down the Red Sea as being one of the major threats we would have to deal with in 2024, or Iran's arming of Russia with drones and missiles, which we talked about previously, Benham, right? This is what you're referring to when you're saying the threat is growing. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And let me just ask you, Bill, if that's okay. I know, you know, guests
of course,
like me and Edmund don't get to turn the tables on you, but
you sure can. You just did.
Thank you. What about the states? You're remarkably consistent on this, and you know, maybe it's because you have the luxury of not living in Washington. But you know, you are remarkably consistent on this when it comes to, again, not just the threat below from Iran and the non-state actors, but the threat above, like the likes of Russia. That inconsistency that exists in the kind of elite American Western foreign policy discourse on what kind of adversary do we have? Is it a 2 out of 10 or a 12 out of 10? You know, take Russia, for example. You've been watching this much better than I, and Edmund, I'm sure you have as well. The way you have some Western analysts talk about Russia, on the one hand, as if Putin is this, you know, KGB, you know, imperial genius, exploiting every opportunity, ready to nuke us at a moment's notice. And on the other hand, apparently someone who is so bad at managing that, you know, there's a terrorist attack under his own nose and he misses it. You know, which is it? You know, we have this war of narratives about our adversaries where some want to make it a 2 out of 10 and just show sheer incompetence. And some want to make it a 12 out of 10 and just have us cower and be afraid or have to produce offsets that some would say are counterproductive or some would say are necessary, whatever you, wherever you stand on that debate. But we seem to not be able to make sense of the threats our adversaries pose and really who they are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. I'm going to use Russia-Ukraine as an example of this. Right at the beginning of the war, what were we told? Putin's a madman. He's going to die. He's, you know, isolated. And now he's the most manipulative, greatest dictator since, you know, Adolf Hitler or right? I mean, well, which is it? He can't be both. He really can't. He's probably somewhere in between. Or we were told that the Russian military was going to run out of supplies, was going to run out of weapons, its soldiers were demoralized. And here we are over 2 years later, and we're begging for weapons and saying, you know, the Ukraine's going to lose if we don't get them X, Y, and Z. Well, which was it? Maybe the truth was somewhere in between, and we don't seem to have that ability. So when we go from one extreme to the other in evaluating our enemies or adversaries, you know, yeah, you're going to get it wrong. I mean, there was probably a lot we could have done better at the outset of the Ukraine war in if we had properly judged, you know, if we didn't pretend, you know, I just keep going back. I just remember just hearing stupid things like, oh, the Russian moms are going to end the war. They're not going to tolerate the casualties of Russia's servicemen. Here we are. I don't know how many thousands, or it's probably tens of thousands. I doubt it's 400,000 Russian dead. That can't be true. And then them winning on the battlefield right now, very, you know, two things that are very unlikely to both be true. You know, and you just get all of these narratives. We get all of these views that, and they conflict, and nobody actually sits down and takes the time and say, maybe we just don't understand what we're looking at. The reality is Russia is a threat. It's a direct threat to Ukraine, but Russia can't, you know, is struggling on the ground in Ukraine. It's gaining ground, but doing so in a slow and grinding manner. Does that mean it's going to invade France or even Germany? I mean, it's got to go all the way through Ukraine in order to make that happen. It's not a direct threat today. Sure, it's a threat maybe 5-10 years from now when the Russians are able to rebuild their military. They're going to have a military that's going to have experienced combat-hardened officers and NCOs. And, you know, they're going to learn lessons. But a lot of these messages are so muddled. They're so all over the place. I realize I just kind of went off on a tangent. We've done this with the Taliban. The Taliban are tired. The Taliban are peaceful. You know, they were so tired and so peaceful that they conquered Afghanistan and we fled. Who was tired, right? Who wanted peace more? We do a lot of projecting with our enemies as well. And I think this is all a great mistake. I mean, interested in your guys' thoughts. I realize that's a little off topic, but you opened the door, Benham.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that is interesting, Bill. I mean, I think what it comes to for me is that we seem to want such simplistic and binary messaging. And I think we just have to grow up and we have to communicate, you know, Western politicians have to communicate to their electorates, you know, that the world is a complicated and dangerous place. And, you know, the fact that somebody isn't 10 foot tall doesn't mean they're not a threat. And, you know, you were talking about the dichotomy of, you know, well, how much of a threat is Putin or how capable is Putin? Well, you know, if you remember the Prigozhin episode, that was a moment when you saw the, you know, the fragility in many ways of what it is that Putin is trying to do. And we just have to manage these things in the terms that they present themselves. And we have, you know, the United States above all, but this is also true of NATO countries and the larger Western countries, the ability to deal with a range of issues at the same time, including outside our realm, you know, the environmental issues or health issues or the various other things that governments have to deal with. I don't know why it is that in the field of foreign and security policy, we have this tendency to chase the ball and say, oh, it's all about counterterrorism. The only thing that matters is Al-Qaeda, which a number of people were saying for a while after 9/11. And now we're in a situation where people talk as if, you know, we either have to figure out how to deal with Ukraine or we have to figure out how to deal with what's happening in the Middle East. No, we have to deal with all of it. And we have to shake people's comfortable assumptions that this is a fundamentally peaceful world. It's a fundamentally conflict riddled and troubled world. And we're quite capable of making our way through this and meeting these challenges. But that does require the ability to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Yeah, but Washington's filled with binary thinking. It's either one or the other. When the reality is that it's multiple choice, right? And we have to be able to, and the answer is all of the above. We have to deal with all of these threats. You even mentioned Prigozhin, right? What were we told after Prigozhin's forces or element of them were marching on Russia? This is the end of Putin. Putin had him shortly afterwards, had him killed in a plane crash, and he absorbed the bulk of Wagner and continued on. Does that mean, you know, he displayed weakness by Prigozhin having the march, but he also displayed strength? What did he show? He's a survivor, and he's a pretty good one. That makes him threatening. It makes him dangerous. But again, not 10 foot tall. And people want easy answers in Washington. Benham, your thoughts on this, since you raised the question.
You know, you kind of gave the answer right at the end. People unfortunately want easy answers in Washington. My fear is that, in general, the quest for analytical parsimony is not limited to Washington. It's a, you know, global capitals thing. In a world where, you know, we're barely finding an electorate that has the time, patience, or interest to finish a full tweet thread, what are we to expect of our politicians? The converse of that is, you know, things like this podcast, things like other podcasts, things like the fact that people are still buying books. We hope that they read them and not just put them up for decorative purposes. there is no shortcut to getting this right. Our brain can help us with some heuristics, you know, how to know when we know something, you know, what kind of a terror group is this? What kind of a foreign leader is that? But beyond that, you know, there's been a real kind of lacking, I would say, and not just the politicians and the electorate, but that group in between, allegedly us, you know, the experts, the foreign policy community, whatever, just because one of the two audiences, be it the electorate or, you know, politicians, may not have the time or interest for this, doesn't mean that we should be dumbing it down or trimming it down. So I think the charge is equally on us. And I'm not saying you or Edmund or me are guilty of it, although probably I am, is that we need to step it up. We need to continue to provide this great information, and particularly in this fashion, this longer form fashion, as the desire to engage with that goes away. You don't like sugarcoat vegetables, because then you add extra calories to them. You ingest the vegetables because you need them, and you need them kind of as they are. If you like turn a piece of celery into some chocolate covered, you know, dessert, you're kind of destroying the purpose of the point of celery. And I fear that we have destroyed the purpose of expertise and open source information.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make one sort of positive comment, you know, because we can sound a little bit Cassandra-like. And you know, we've talked a lot about adversaries, and we know what an adversary looks like: an agent of chaos, a serial invader of neighboring countries, a terrorist group that kills civilians. Adversaries are clear enough. It's quite interesting, isn't it, though, to just briefly turn to allies. Who are our allies? Because that's a more hopeful message. And one of the interesting things that has happened since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine is a very substantial reinforcing of NATO, including the joining of Finland and Sweden to NATO. And this is something I think we don't think about enough. And that is, which side are we on? You know, who do we actually want on our team? And, you know, it's very clear when you've got something like the Five Eyes, you know, the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Five Eyes intelligence relationship. I mean, these are friends and allies in every respect, you know, see the world in very similar ways, and deeply committed to the rule of law and to Western values and all that good stuff. Then you've got, you know, NATO, which is very much in that same sort of camp. I mean, you have different members of NATO with perhaps slightly different levels of differing levels of commitment. But broadly speaking, NATO is an extraordinary positive. It's been a very powerful, very effective alliance, and it's one that we should absolutely treasure. And then, you know, when we look at this dynamic in the Middle East, let's be absolutely clear. Which side are we on here? Are we on the side of terrorists? Are we on the side of people who attack ships in the Red Sea, people who care nothing about freedom of navigation, nothing about polluting the waters of the Red Sea? Are we on the side of people who slaughter civilians and boast about it? No, we're on Israel's side. Israel is an ally. Israel is a country that lives by the rule of law in a very, very difficult situation, but nevertheless does its best to be bound by the rules-based international system and has the rule of law at home, as well as being a democracy, a functioning democracy. So I think this is an interesting way also to look at this. Let's be very clear about building the relations that we need and the alliances that we need and reinforcing the alliances that we have, and not getting distracted in such a way that we end up in fights with our own allies.
No, it's a good point. And it is good. We do tend to see the downsides here. I will say that, you know, Cassandra was given the gift of prophecy, but cursed to have no one believe her. And so I'm a Cassandra fan. So I view that as a compliment. I think she's the most misunderstood character in Greek mythology, but that's another thing I taught myself as a kid, but that's neither here nor there. It is interesting, you know, but we've also seen here goes the Cassandra bill. But we've also seen that NATO, while uniting on the issue of Ukraine, not doing the things needed to be done to get weapons to Ukraine. But there are positives, and you are correct, Edmund. It is good to see when the chips are down, where the countries, you know, come down and where they provide their support. I think some of the support for Israel has been lacking, particularly from countries like Canada, who really should know better. But yeah, it is heartening to see at times that, you know, all is not lost. And that is for certain. As pessimistic as I could be at times, I do have to remind myself that, you know, all is not lost. And we do have the ability to fix these problems. I just really wish we would do them a lot faster and a lot more efficiently. But let's move on to get back to the topic of Iran. And, you know, these are important. You know, we got to just devote an episode to just what we talked about here. It's really a lot to dig in deeper, because these are part of the real problems. If we're not, you know, it's hard to get to the solutions when we can't properly identify the problems. I think that's what we do here. It is why we sound like pessimists at times, because we're looking at the problems. And I'm just a big believer in getting the problems right before you're coming up with solutions. We do have the tendency here. I think we have the ability here to see what the problems are. I don't pretend to have all the answers on the solutions. And I know Benham and Edmund, as I would think they would agree with me on that. But our key is to get the problems right, to identify them, and then we can start looking at solutions. But Iran's development of its nuclear program, it's forced the U.S. particularly in the 2000s, to take a more aggressive diplomatic stance, and the U.S. imposed tough sanctions, and that brought Iran to the table to sign the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's the, you know, agreement between the U.S. and the West for Iran to curb its nuclear program. We could discuss the efficacy and how wise is the JCPOA. You know, that's certainly another discussion here. But was this enough to curb Iran's efforts to undermine the West in the Middle East and beyond? I'll start with you, Benham.
Well, what is the this there? Well, what is the this that is sufficient to curb their efforts?
The signing of the JCPOA. And
no, the signing of the JCPOA I see as an accelerant to the problem.
I totally agree with you, Benham. Yes.
and here, you know, this could be a measure of where you stand in life depends on where you sit. This could be philosophical, as in, are you trying to solve the problem or are you trying to manage the problem? This could be, you know, bureaucratic and government based, as in, how do you rank order the threats from the Islamic Republic and where do you relieve pressure in order to get something? There are so many ways to skin this cat, but the way I see it is it's kind of like a wedding cake. The nuclear is, you know, the top layer of the cake. It's brought to you by this architecture of a threat that has existed and grown. And the nuclear part is actually a relatively recent one. It's one that, you know, was exposed in 2002, even though Iran in 1983 resurrected the late Shah's nuclear program. And from there, you don't have a straight line to a bomb. You have this sporadic, mixed, two steps forward, one step back, half overt, half covert, faux civilian rationale system going on, where the Islamic Republic is trying to build up this capability, but pursue the dividends a nuclear weapon grants them in the safest way possible. And when you look today, deal or no deal, sanctions or no sanctions, the Islamic Republic seems to be benefiting from the biggest dividend of having a nuclear weapon without having overtly, moved towards it or having been detected as engaging in weaponization. And that dividend is the fact that you have had no overt kinetic U.S., Israeli, or Western strike on Iranian territory. That is the whole point of the nuclear weapon, right? There's always the chance they could use it, particularly for a regime like the Islamic Republic, which, said what they said about chemical weapons, were victims of chemical weapons attacks during the bulk of the Iran-Iraq War. But then, starting, according to the U.S. intelligence community, in April 1997, the regime removed, and I'm almost paraphrasing CIA reporting here, political and religious barriers to WMD activity, and began to actually develop and even employed on select occasions chemical weapons in the war with Iraq. And so those who take solace in some kind of nuclear fatwa or even a nuclear deal, because there may be religious or political constraints, ought not to take that solace, to the bank, because there'll be an expiration date for that. So right now you have the regime kind of emboldened. You have sanctions atrophying. You have no kind of deal to curb or roll back or even solve the nuclear program in sight. And that emboldenment has produced a kind of a boom and bust cycle of violence from the Islamic Republic that is leading it to do things that some would not have predicted. Iran actually responds to pressure today with pressure of its own. There used to be a kind of a talking point, talk about, crass things that people in capital say, be it officials or experts, that Iran backs down the face of pressure. Now we have that empirical track record of Iran responding to pressure with pressure of its own. We now have Iran almost fighting against NATO. 2-3 years ago, the Europeans mocked those across the Atlantic who worried about Iranian weapons proliferation and the collapse of a UN arms embargo. Now European citizens and critical infrastructure and cities are being threatened with cheaper, lower, and slower flying Iranian weapons like drones, and may soon be threatened with higher and faster flying weapons like ballistic missiles. And to bring this back to nuclear, meaning, is there something we should do, or at what point are we waiting for an alarm bell to go off? It seems like now the consensus, and I'm just kind of trying to connect the dots here, no one has said this, in the transatlantic community and in the analytical community, and I would assume in the IC, but also even within different legislative halls of power, is that some will say, as long as Iran doesn't go to 90%, which is weapons grade, we'll tolerate all this nuclear escalation. And so what if it's emboldening the regime? We'll come up with the offsets. They fire missiles. We'll have anti-whatever missiles. They believe they have this covered. Here's the kicker on the nuclear file, which is the United States of America, the only country to drop atomic weapons, dropped one plutonium bomb and one uranium bomb in World War II. And the uranium bomb we dropped was not enriched to 90% purity, so it was not technically weapons grade. It was enriched to 80% purity. Last February, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or I should say last January, February, found uranium particles in Iran that were enriched to 84%, 4% over what we had when we dropped the only uranium bomb in history during war, and a stone's throw from 90%, this, what we used to think was a technical threshold. Now, holding back our sanctions, holding back a real change in Iran policy, just because Iran hasn't got to 90%, in my view now, and really since January, February 2023, makes zero strategic sense. Because again, they went to 84%. They backed that down. They haven't stockpiled it. That's okay. That's good. But the Iranians could have been practicing enriching to 90 and simply have gotten caught. And it's in this world where we have less and less and less time on the nuclear clock, and less room for maneuver, which is bringing to the fore a lot of very nasty options. And if we're going to have to entertain nasty options, we might as well begin to set the groundwork for that now and on the easier to manage issues. Who knew I would say that the regional front might be easier than the nuclear? But if this is how it's going to be, we need to get the ducks in order. If we need to have Iran fear U.S. military power, we are at least going to have to bare our teeth better against the Houthis, which are a proxy, or the Shia militias, for example. We have to get the deterrence game right outside Iran before anything even happens remotely inside Iran. This is not a call for military action inside Iran, but it's an understanding that whether you're looking to stop bad behavior inside or outside, you're going to have to fundamentally beef up your deterrence game. And that's just not deterrence by denial, bringing this architecture of air and missile defenses and ships and personnel and whatever into the region, but it's actually deterrence by punishment. It's about fighting back and threatening that which the regime holds dear, so it knows that it will lose more than it will gain in this entire trade-off on the nuclear, on the regional, on whatever.
So, Edmund, do you think we are appropriately using deterrence against Iran? Is our deterrence working?
Not fully, no. And I do agree with what Benham's saying there. I think he's absolutely right. I don't want to suggest that the United States, the West, has not done anything. There has been some useful, I think, completely correct pushback. Absolutely right to be facing down the Houthis in the Red Sea. Absolutely, I think the way that the United States is playing its deterrence of the Iraqi militia violence whilst sustaining a sense in the Iraqi government that the Iraqi government needs the US as an ally and as a guarantor of security. I can absolutely see the way that that's been played and the sort of a rather, I think Ben would probably say as a slight obsession with proportionality. But the point is that this is not enough to establish deterrence, and that's now clear. The Houthis are still doing what they're doing, and that's partly because they can do it at relatively low cost. And in any case, they don't care if they don't care if they lose equipment. They don't really care if they lose personnel. Where as long as they can create the sort of the chaos and uncertainty in the Red Sea that is doing the damage that it is doing, then they're going to carry on doing it at least for the foreseeable future. Lebanese Hezbollah, is continuing to attack Israel across the northern border with, limited consequences. The consequences, all of them, of course, coming from Israel and Israel's ability to operate a level of deterrence against Lebanese Hezbollah. So it's quite clear now that there is a need to increase the cost to Iran, as Benham says. And Iran is a rational actor. It looks at what happens, what it gains and what it loses from any action at the moment. It's finding that it's mainly gaining and it's not losing too much. And it's able to, make small adjustments in order to limit the consequences of its bad actions. So, moving the Beshad ship around, putting it into, taking it out of the Red Sea, putting it into a safe port and things like that. But feeling able to sort of continue to play with fire in that way that is directly threatening US and allied lives, as well as threatening the environment and threatening peaceful ships and international trade. So they've done that. That they made those sort of adjustments. They had a disagreement with India about interfering with shipping in the Indian Ocean, and they very quickly backed down from that because they realized that, no, actually, the Indians are not going to tolerate this, and we can't afford to get into a confrontation with them. It was interesting that Kataib Hezbollah, the Iraqi militia group, said, oh, we're going to suspend our attacks on the Americans for a little while. Again, that was clearly at a moment where the response of the Biden administration spooked the Iranians. They were worried. They thought, hang on a sec, have we just stepped beyond the undeclared red line? And are we going to suffer some serious consequences as a result? And then you've got that little bit of preemptive maneuvering in getting Kataib Hezbollah to say that they wouldn't attack the Americans for now. And of course, the Iranians are playing that game, that sort of cat and mouse game all the time. And they're going to keep playing it. And the problem is that unless we raise the stakes for them, they're going to think that actually they're continuing to gain. So, to my mind, the very first casualty of this should have been the Beshad. The Beshad should either have been seized or sunk. That would have sent a message to the Iranians that if you get involved in this kind of illegal international activity, your assets will be targets.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on particularly on that last point. And I would, the problem I think with the Houthis is we're not, we target things. We're not targeting the right people. And that would include Iranian advisors on the ground, top Houthis, top leadership. You said it, Edmund, the Houthis will sacrifice military equipment that the Iranians will gladly resupply all day and all night long and all year long. Benham, Edmund, I think he identified that he would definitely say that the Iranians are gaining in its strategy to leverage its proxies, particularly since the war with Hamas broke out, Israel's war with Hamas broke out on October 7th. What's your position on that?
I certainly do believe, unfortunately, I should say, I certainly do believe the Iranians have made quite a few gains. And what Edmund was alluding to, the spigot, if you will, of Iran-backed violence itself, or more often than not, through these proxy forces, that's something that has a political purpose to it. You know, Iran is still trying to achieve political goals, but the tools it has are military means. They're military tools. And this is something I think that actually presents the West with an opportunity because it simply has more military tools. The problem is once you take these tools and you create a binary between war and peace, and you put the handcuffs on these tools, and you segregate out diplomacy and cyber and intelligence and military and economic, rather than see them as mutually reinforcing and linked and as more of a continuum, you know, legal thresholds for the use of each, obviously, notwithstanding, you get the weird situation that you have now in the Middle East, which particularly in the post-October 7 Middle East, but in the lead up to that as well, which is in almost every jurisdiction where we say there is no military solution, Iran or Iran-backed forces are looking for a military solution or have found a military solution. This also applies to conflicts in Eurasia as well. And it's kind of funny how that works. As soon as we say there is no military solution, there's a whole new series of military facts on the ground. And Edmund has hit the nail on the head about the Behshad because they are rational actors. I fear a rational adversary much more than an irrational one, particularly a means-ends rational that has limited means and knows how to pursue that end with the dispensation of those means based on the environment. And if an Iranian allegedly destroyer, but it's actually a frigate, Alvand class, tried to go towards the Red Sea as it did a few months ago and was not stopped, yet for some reason international shipping that has to be stopped in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb, I don't know why that's permitted to be the case. I also don't know why we permit, as Edmund mentioned, with respect to the Behshad, the precursor or the follow-up to the Saviz, which was also another self-styled IRGC spy vessel helping the Houthis in that region. I also don't know why this is kind of permitted to not just remain, whether it was in the Gulf of Aden or in the Red Sea, but how we kind of have put handcuffs on ourselves and say, no, we can't take a ship, that would be illegal, or we can't target a ship, that would be illegal. When we have the causal chain all backwards, it's the illegal activity of the ship that is necessitating such a response. Had the ship not been doing that, then we may not have felt a need or may not have even had a need to even pontificate ways to target that vessel by seizure or by military force or allegedly what has happened in the past few months, which is via cyber-enabled means. So this is a product, what we have now, of the conceptualization of these divides that we've created. And because Iran does not have those divides, they have had gains. You know, they have an ultimate political goal that they have not achieved, which is a ceasefire and the ability to save Hamas, probably the lowest of the low-hanging fruit of the axis of resistance. But one big gain is the interoperability of this network, this axis of resistance, the bringing on online of fire in Syria and Iraq to create military pressure against the United States, the bringing online of the Houthis in the Red Sea to put more military pressure. The diverse targeting of the Houthis, first Israel, then international shipping, and now potentially Israel again. Recently, there was a reportedly successful land attack cruise missile strike, the first ever by the Houthis, being able to reach Israel proper. You know, these are game-changing developments. And this is just the start of the movie for Iran. Another gain, of course, is that it'll rinse and repeat. You know, Israelis are often fond of talking about how Hamas officials have said there will be another and another October 7. But right here is that you may have more and more Iran-backed network-centric warfare based on how they believe they survived the post-October 7 Middle East. It's not just about having another October 7. It's about the regime having the ability to dangle this network after it does another October 7 as a deterrent to you, to the West, to America, to Israel, to the UK, to the EU, to whomever, when it attempts to respond to an already established series of bad behaviors by the regime. So it's not going to stop the low-intensity stuff. It's not going to stop the terrorism. But now it has a tool to threaten deterrence by punishment against you for trying to offset the problem that we had with them to begin with, which was terrorism.
You know, I'm going to make two quick points before we move on. You know, you had said, you know, no military solution. This is one of my biggest complaints in all of this. I always go back to that. You know, we said this about Afghanistan. There's no military solution to Afghanistan. Yet the Taliban had one. We witnessed it, right? They took control of a country militarily, obviously, and using politics to get the U.S. out, using diplomacy. We limit only ourselves, and the Houthis are the best example of this. I think it's a great example of what you were talking about, Ben. You know, if you look at the daily drumbeat of attacks between the Houthi attacks and U.S. response, you would think you're at a war. You would think you are in a war, but the U.S. officials are we're not at war with the Houthis. We're not at war with Iran. Well, newsflash, it looks like they're at one with us, and yet we limit our fire. We limit our capabilities. We have all the ability to put a hurting on the Houthis so that they can't launch missiles and drones at our warships and at commercial shipping. But we choose not to use them, and we limit ourselves. We respond proportionally. And I think this is why our deterrence doesn't work. Any comments from either of you on that?
Absolutely, Bill. And I'm glad you made that segue, because, you know, this is where I get to, you know, express some of my frustration as a former British ambassador to Yemen. You know, it was always frustrating to me that we were not clearer about whose side we were on in the Yemen conflict. You know, that Saudi Arabia did not invade Yemen. Saudi Arabia was asked by the legitimate government of Yemen to protect it against the Houthi insurrection. That's what happened in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is not the aggressor, and yet we allowed ourselves to get distracted by a lot of really ill-informed criticism of the Saudis, to some degree criticism of the Emiratis and others who were part of that Saudi-led coalition. And there are a couple of points to be made from that. You know, one is we need to be more consistent. And again, who are our allies? That point that I made earlier, you know, let's be clear about who our allies are. Saudi Arabia is a controversial country in the West, but it is wedded to the rule of law, and it's wedded to the rules-based international system. And it is and has been a fairly dependable ally to the West in many ways. And we should have been absolutely clear, and we should still be absolutely clear, whose side we're on in this conflict. We're on the side of the internationally recognized government of Yemen and its Saudi and Emirati and other allies. And so the next point to be made here is that the Houthis are not a government. They're not recognized. They're not legal. There is no reason why they should be off limits for kinetic targeting of the kind that the US has regularly used against terrorist groups elsewhere in the world. You know, the US has not hesitated to kill Al-Qaeda and ISIL figures. Now, you know, I understand why people think, you know, people ask the question about what do you do when you're dealing with the officials of a government. It's one of the things that, you know, that has to be carefully thought through. But that even that issue doesn't exist with the Houthis. The Houthis are simply an illegal terrorist group, militia, occupying the capital of a country that actually has an internationally recognized government sitting in Aden. So we should be far less inhibited than we have been with the Houthis. There should be no hesitation to take out key Houthi individuals.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Our messaging on Yemen and many other places have been muddled, and these are problems. You know, we should have seen this coming. We should have seen, you know, the problems that the Houthis staying in power and maintaining a military. Look, they were launching attack and shipping venom. How many years since, what, 2015, 16? Is that correct?
Since the war, since the Decisive Storm?
The Houthis launched attacks on shipping prior
to
absolutely.
The first one on the U.S. was October 2016. The U.S. has made.
Right. Exactly. So this has been happening. We should have seen this. And yet we look, I understand there's a lot of politics.
But you know what, though? But you know what? This was a problem, because it happened a little bit in 2016. There was a little bit of application of military force, and then everyone moved on. And then starting in 2018, 2019, there was a whole host of things Iranian military officials said about the Red Sea. In particular, I think one of them was a Quds Force official. I don't think it was Soleimani or Ghani, but I have to double check. 2018, 2019. And when we would translate and share those comments with academics, policymakers, what have you, and the fear I had was that Iran was slow motion exporting its A2AD maritime harassment response to pressure with pressure of its own strategy from the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz to the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandeb and Gulf of Aden. This was laughed at by basically the mainstream analytical community, because their point of reference was what you just mentioned, which was the 2016. Look, they fired an anti-ship missile. We hit two radars. They stopped. So we're all good. But that's the world is much more kinetic and dynamic than that.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes we should take them at their word when they make threats, such as wanting to dominate the Red Sea. We should listen. The Iranians have a long history of backing their threats with action. We want the Iranians to stop. Go ahead.
Well, and Bill, so yes, we should listen and we should absolutely respond. And this is one of the most frustrating things and one of the most baffling things, considering the power of NATO, considering the power of the United States. When the Iranians go on the record and say that they intend to, you know, to intervene in shipping, you know, international shipping in the Red Sea, it's necessary at that point for the United States and others to go on the record and say, no, you won't. And if you try to do so, it will be an act of war and it will be met with military force.
Yeah, and we have means to, you know, again, the Iranian ships, the Bashu, the other intelligence gathering ships, they should be at the bottom of the ocean. Or maybe just disable the rudders, things like or disable the propellers. There are things that we are capable of doing and we just refuse to do it. We handcuff ourselves. That's the most frustrating thing that I've seen in covering these wars, because somehow we've become, well, we have to respond proportionally. Look, we're doing this to the Israelis right now as they fight Hamas, as if there's a way to proportionally go up against an enemy that fights amongst civilians, hides in tunnels and fights from tunnels. And, you know, it's this type of thinking. It's what got us into this. And yet we seem to double down on this. So I think we could all agree Iran has had great success in using proxies to fight its battle. Edmund, I think you alluded to some of the drawbacks to its use of proxies. I'll start with you, Benham. What are some of the downfalls for Iran in its use of its proxies? We've seen a lot of success with Hezbollah and all of the proxy militias, but can you list some downsides?
So I would say at the outset that I don't think there have been that many downsides for them, or they have not been made to realize those downsides. With that said, and I mean, one reason I believe they haven't been made to pay that price is, of course, every conflict has been adjudicated involving a proxy away from the soil of the patron that backs that proxy. But there is essentially the covert element of the proxy strategy, which was designed to mask Iran's hand. You remember, both of you, from the Iraq days, you know, serial numbers filed off of weapons that came from Iran, the U.S. and the coalition literally chemically having to get involved in the IED and EFP scenario to trace where the copper in the IEDs and EFPs came from, and was able to even pinpoint the mine and the facility in Iran where the copper, you know, was believed to have come from for these things. Over time, this has become a calling card rather than a denial for the Iranians. So it's a denial in the sense that it masks their hand. But over time, this is a calling card. In 2022 and 2023, the Houthis were parading as close as I've ever seen in my life, literal carbon copies of Iranian ballistic missiles, same fin structure, same, you know, body structure, same warhead structure, literal carbon copies. And that's some of the stuff now, at least on the anti-ship front, that they're using in the Red Sea and in the Bab el-Mandeb and Gulf of Aden. So in this sense, if we take this to its logical conclusion, the more it's the calling card, the more it should be subject to paying the price for that. But then again, the regime hasn't paid the price for that. One might raise connective tissue issues, which is that the more you have, the more you have to manage. For instance, if you have more people, you have to pay them more. In a situation like you had from 2018 to 2020, resources were scarcer. So that's one, resource scarcity. You're more subject to pressure. Two is, of course, local agency issues. There are some militias that did not want to stop firing during the Saudi-Iran detente period of 2023, just like there were reports in January, February involving Kataib Hezbollah's view of Ismail Ghani's trip to Iraq. So you'll always have local actor agency, but the regime grants these groups long leashes anyway, because on balance, they're shooting at people that the regime in Tehran wants to shoot at. Never has local actor agency with Lebanese Hezbollah, for example, threatened the regime's interests. In fact, you've seen Nasrallah's hesitance to get more directly involved, literally parallel Khamenei style, which is to say, we didn't do October 7. We fully support the Palestinians, and we're not going to get directly involved, but then incrementally get involved. So I still am struggling with all of this to see the downsides.
Yeah, Ben, what you described there, like, to me, that's actually an upside, right? That sometimes difficulty keeping your proxy on a leash, right? You got that, you know, at the end of the day, the Iranians can rely on Kataib Hezbollah to go toe-to-toe with the U.S. if it wants to. So yeah, sure, it can be difficult. And then they have their plausible deniability, right, built in. There's just everything you described, right, that plausible deniability in the supplying of the weapons or in directing these groups. The Iranians can sit back and say, that's not us. We don't control them. They're not our weapons systems. While everyone knows that they control them and knows it, but those who need the out in the West, policymakers and politicians, will turn around and say, see, the Iranians said they don't control them, and they don't, and we don't have pictures of them at the factory building the weapons and then delivering them with UPS to Kataib Hezbollah. So yeah, I think that in some ways these aren't real. I'm with you. I see whatever problems that exist, and they do exist, there are some problems, they're inconsequential to the benefits. Your thoughts, Edmund?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think they are very limited compared to the benefits, but I don't think they have to be. I mean, I think, you know, if we were
being, we don't exploit them. That's for certain.
They are there to be exploited, and we don't do enough to exploit them. You know, so one of the issues that you know, if you think about clarity of messaging, if you are simply Hamas, and you are simply Hamas and Iran sort of talking in support of Hamas, then you've got a fairly easy communication challenge in terms of what's happening in Gaza. You know, of course, you're not going to be honest about it. You're going to be providing a very slanted communication about it. But it's relatively easy to do. You can sort of paint the Israelis as being, you know, cruel and disproportionate and all that sort of thing. Once you mix your agenda with a bunch of other agendas, that becomes more difficult. And, you know, so what's the justification for Hezbollah attacking northern Israel? That's less clear. What's the justification for Iraqi Shia groups attacking the Americans who came to rescue Iraq from ISIS? That's even less clear. What's the justification for the Houthis polluting the Red Sea by sinking ships? Preventing aid shipments from reaching Hodeidah because they can't safely transit the Suez Canal or the Bab el-Mandeb.
Food supplies aren't making it through like you'd like to. Exactly. They're all starving.
Well, and not only that, but then you're damaging the Egyptian economy. You know, Egyptians are suffering hardship because the Suez Canal revenues are down. Food is not necessarily reaching people who need it in Africa and things like that. So. The point about this is that the messaging becomes increasingly difficult. In fact, you know, if we're sensible about the way that we counter message, the messaging becomes entirely non-credible because of these other actors who are involved and wanting to do things which are just absolutely nothing to do with Israel-Palestine. And that also applies more widely, because you've got this very alarming alignment that has developed, an alliance that has developed now between Iran and Russia. And that is highly problematic. You know, it's a, you know, it used to be that, you know, certainly at the time of the JCPOA agreement, that one of the reasons why the JCPOA agreement happened was because at that time you had discussions in which Russia was a full participant, and was, you know, effectively the Iranians were looking at a situation where the international community was largely aligned against them, and they were so they, you know, they were happy with this JCPOA agreement, I think partly because they felt that they got a reasonably good deal out of it. And I think we can, you know, let's not revisit that issue, but, you know, I understand why the JCPOA was negotiated and signed. I do have some sympathy with people who say that it was a poor deal and that it should have been much harder on Iran than it was. But now Russia is no longer part of any kind of alignment against Iran. Russia has aligned itself with Iran. And that's a strength for the Iranians. Maybe it's a strength for the Russians in a way, but it also is importing all sorts of inconsistencies and problems. You know, Russia has just been attacked by ISIS in Moscow. Now, Iran is not aligned with ISIS, and that's not something, that's not a particular bone of contention between the two countries. But the fact of the matter is that Russia has a long-standing problem with Islamic extremism, including with al-Qaeda, and Iran is allied with al-Qaeda. So my point is that this sort of axis of resistance, and I'm not sure, you know, whether we include Russia in that axis or not, it's a sort of slightly different arena, but the axis of resistance has within it many contradictions, and we should be playing on those contradictions much more aggressively.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. We have this axis of evil situation, sorry to borrow a phrase, 2.0, with the state actors. You have tiers of state actors. You got Russia, China at the top. You got North Korea, Iran in the middle. You got Syria, Cuba, Venezuela at the bottom. And then you have the non-state actors that emanate and emerge as extensions of the foreign and security policy apparatus of each. And in particular with Iran's, I would say it's the most robust compared to any of those actors. And it has, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. It has the Assad regime. It has whatever. It doesn't mean that we can separate all of these overnight. In fact, we may not even be able to separate. And in fact, some policies designed to fully separate could be counterproductive. You know, I can think of going back at least to the Bush administration, the second Bush administration in Washington, where the idea of can we split Syria from Iran, how many times has Washington had that debate? And I think the trend lines for Iran and Russia are set to grow. But what we can do is introduce more transaction costs for that relationship. Given the structural discrepancy, these guys are competing at the moment to sell discounted illegal oil to China, because both of their oil is still subject to sanctions. But despite that competition, what we have to realize is that oftentimes, America's adversaries, and in general, authoritarians, are much better about quarantining and compartmentalizing the conflicts they have with another and playing up the partnership component. You know, Iran and Turkey do this even, let alone Iran and Russia, which has a fundamentally different kind of historical relationship. And we can introduce those transaction costs. We can limit room for maneuverability. You know, the Iranian foreign policy issue is an issue on the Iranian street against the state. You hear this in protests. Since 2009, people have been chanting, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran. Since 2017-18, they've been chanting, forget Syria, think about us. But the Iranian people also don't like the Russians. You know, no country has taken more territory away from Iran in the past 500 years than Russia, or done more damage to Iranian national interests than Russia in three forms, in Tsarist, Soviet Union, and now the Russian Federation. You know, Iran finally got the S-300 on the back end of the JCPOA, but Russia was much more willing to sell and even freely transfer the S-400 to Syria. And Iran is still dreaming of getting that. So Russia has strung Iran along. And when Russia got more involved in Syria, it was staging bombers from Iranian bases to strike Syria in 2015, 2016, if you remember. This created a huge source of pressure on the regime, because the regime's slogan, its motto, is neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. And these guys cut their teeth on coming into power on not having Iran be some kind of foreign base. And here they are opening up Iran to being some kind of foreign base. And the trend line is to take the motto of the regime, neither East nor West Islamic Republic, they are increasingly going to be to fight the West and preserve the Islamic Republic, go East. And we have to introduce as many transaction costs into that relationship as possible, knowing full well that it's not going to stop them, but it's going to make it much, much, much harder. And I think that is the prudent strategy.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, I also believe we should be doing more to help the opposition within Iran. I mean, I'm not sure what we can do there. I realize that's a whole subject within itself, but it just seems that the last three administrations have had zero desire to support the Iranian opposition in any way, shape, or form. Am I wrong on that, Benham?
It's been ebbs and flows, but, you know, FDD has actually put out something, and, you know, we're proud to have coined the phrase, and now it's kind of proliferated everywhere. You have Iranian opposition groups saying it, you have senators saying it, you have whatever, called maximum support. And we're basically saying, you know, there is going to be another wave of protests in Iran. The West can't afford to keep getting caught flat-footed. Even if you want to be super cynical and, you know, pursue very narrow interests against the regime, you're going to need to know that there's going to be an expiration date to the pursuit of those policies and interests, because it's not going to have any rooting. And so it behooves us, particularly if we believe the things we believe in and kind of want to be the states that we espouse to be and historically have talked about, is to actually marry our strategy with our values. And in fact, Iran is the easiest place to do that. You know, fundamentally one of the most pro-American, pro-Western populations, the only place that, you know, didn't start, you know, Palestine is not a measure of this, but at least in terms of Hamas, it might be, didn't start putting up Palestinian flags after October 7. You only see in Iran Palestinian flags in official government offices. Now contrast that with the heartland of the Muslim world and the Arab Middle East. You have a fundamentally different kind of population here. And in that maximum support policy, which we kind of envision to be a paradigm, a complementary paradigm for maximum pressure, where you have pressure on the regime, support for the population. This is everything from targeted designations that really name and shame even the most local level judges and commanders, so that the Iranian people know that their oppressors are being held accountable. We should be engaging in blanket visa bans for whole organizations that repress the Iranian people. We should be sanctioning some of the wealth they have abroad under Magnitsky authorities. You know, Australia, America, New Zealand, the EU, Canada, the US have unique anti-corruption laws that they could be using here. We should be revoking and limiting the size of the Iranian diplomatic delegations anywhere in the world. We should be making sure the Iranian government officials who deny their population access to a lot of these social media platforms or make them access it through VPNs. We should be kicking off those individuals, particularly those who espouse hate speech on these platforms and deny these platforms to their own population. You know, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei certainly comes to mind. And then even beyond that, we should be working to, you know, confiscate assets of the regime abroad and find a way to pass them back to the Iranian people. You know, we did a lot of this stuff with solidarity movements, you know, the U.S. and particularly the CIA, with the solidarity movement in Poland in the Cold War. We could and should be doing that stuff here. Think creatively about strike funds. Think creatively about, you know, getting Starlink, that satellite internet, into Iran, and really playing the long game as to introducing more shocks, more pressure into the way the regime tries to control the population. And hey, this doesn't just have to be about feel-good stuff. This can be about great power competition, because a lot of the surveillance tech that the regime has is Chinese. You know, Tencent, TND, all of these sanctioned Chinese firms that do surveillance and facial recognition software and internet monitoring that we are rightly concerned about vis-a-vis the Uyghurs in China. These are companies that have subsidiaries and offshoots and branches that are active in Tehran today.
Can I also just add a point?
Absolutely.
Ben, proscription of the IRGC. The IRGC has to be proscribed as a terrorist organization. This is absolutely
Amen.
Massively, massively overdue. And also, can I come back to a point I think that you were very much making at the beginning of what you were just saying? You know, if you're looking for an international game changer, that, you know, when you think of the conflicts, the challenges that we've been talking about, I can't think of a better international game changer than regime change in Iran. Because as you say, Iran is a highly sophisticated, very, in societal terms, very pro-Western, very liberal, It's one of the great civilizations of the earth. The Iranians are proud people. They're proud of their civilization. And if they were allowed to govern themselves in the way that they wish, Iran would immediately, overnight, change into a constructive actor, as well as a major economy in that region. And so, you know, we should be absolutely thinking, you know, what might change significantly to affect the calculus for the West in a positive way. And I can't think of anything more positive than change in Iran.
Yeah, and yet, instead of doing all of what you, what both Edmund and Benham had mentioned here, we grant Iran access to $10 billion more as Iran is sponsoring proxies to kill Americans, to shut down shipping. It's just, it's mind-boggling when we look at it. Well, look, any parting thoughts from you, Edmund? Or did we get it all in today?
I think we probably got it all in. I mean, I wanted to sort of end on that sort of slightly optimistic note about the fact that, you know, there is a scenario in which this does shift in a very positive way for the West and for the international rule of law and the rules-based international system. And we just need to work harder on it. And we need to be really clear, as I said, who our friends are, who our enemies are. And if we want to be absolutely clear about an enemy of everything that we value, it is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yeah, you said clear. And as you were speaking, I was saying, but we need clarity. And you said the word I wanted to hear. Benham, any your parting thoughts?
Edmund, he literally hit the nail on the head once again. I couldn't have said it better myself. Prescription of the IRGC is going to be the prescription of the IRGC is going to be the thing that allows us to get into the right mindset to deal with the Islamic Republic. It's not going to change something overnight. If we had done it much earlier, it would have provided wind beneath the wings to the hundreds of thousands of Iranian protesters that came into the streets from 2022 to 2023. Now it's a bit late to try to kind of artificially resurrect that, but there will be another chance. And if we do this multilaterally in jurisdictions where from the Iranian diaspora to the parliaments, to the foreign ministries of these country have had great connective tissue since 2022, 2023, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the EU, the UK, that would be a significant setback to the Islamic Republic. But moving forward, the first sign of clarity, step number one, do no harm. Do not reward a regime materially, financially, or in any other way that is that engages in the kind of foreign aggression and domestic suppression that we talked about today. That could probably be the most constructive thing and the easiest thing for any administration, any government to do moving forward. But the way Edmund kind of brought this into the, slowly parked this ship into the dock of regime change, that is really the ultimate game changer here. If you take the queen off the board, you take the connective tissue out between the mid powers and the great powers that are anti-status quo, anti-American, anti-Western, and the connective tissue between the patron and the proxy when it comes to axes of resistance, that would be the ultimate of ultimate game changers.
Yeah, without the spider making the web of proxies, I think we wouldn't see the Houthis be the threat they were, the Iraqi and Syrian militias and Hezbollah, they would wither on the vine. Edmund, Benham, excellent conversation. Many thanks for joining Generation Jihad today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bill. Thanks, Benham.
Thank you both. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Always great. We're going to continue these conversations. We're working on our Axis of Resistance project, and we'll start drilling down into the militias and discuss their roles. Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.